And today we are going to take in hand, but not exhaust nor answer all the questions regarding this text that was ably translated for us by our group three or four or whatever group number you guys were. I rather than have you guess, here's the outline. We'll just talk about it together, okay? So I'll just kind of work on this, and you've got it, and so that way you can see and ask good questions and so forth. Oh, and I get to ask you also how many times he told you stink. Well, he meant spiritually. Yeah, right. Here's the, I got a handout. They're going to think, why is he bothering to record this thing? It's so disorganized. Here's the I read Matthew page. Now, you only have to have read it. I mean, it doesn't count like that you had 2 weeks off, so they have to read it like nine times or something. That doesn't count. Since the last week of the term. If you read it nine times, I'm happy for you. I've read it a lot more than that. So. Okay. Okay, structure of the text. You remember it's essentially two parts, easy enough. The Baptist sends to, you know, a couple of his disciples. The variant reading says two. The proper reading is probably through. And Jesus answers him with a kind of an enigmatic twist at the end of the answer. And then as those disciples of John are going away, Jesus begins to teach the crowds, it specifically says, as you know, the crowds, about John's significance. And in so doing, because of the, and this is, we talked about this a little bit, of how really remarkably significant a human figure John the Baptizer is in the history of salvation, right? Because of who John is, then you learn also about the time in which these words are being spoken and these deeds are being carried out. And you also learn about the significance of the one to whom John pointed in a kind of an indirect way, right? So structure, it's easy enough. I think it's usually put together in the applicable system as well, although you don't read all the way to verse 15, which mystifies me a little bit. So verses 2 to 6 is John's query and Jesus' response. And then 3 points under A, John's question on the surface. And I think rightly so indicates some wondering in his mind, at least, about the timing of how and when God's reign in Jesus is going to manifest itself. And so Jesus answers John by echoing very strongly Isaiah, phrases especially from chapter 35 and 61. So his answer is yes. Are you the coming one? The answer is yes. Look what's happening. Okay. But there is something odd about it, and that's why Jesus probably doesn't just say yes. Right? He says, go tell John what you see and hear, and then after, you know, at the end of verse 5, blessed are and the poor have good news preached to them, and then he says, blessed is the one who's not caused to stumble because of it. See, so that last verse in Jesus' answer to John lets us, and really is almost a segue into the second half of the text. Now, on the last day, Jesus won't have to say things like, let the one who has ears hear. Okay? Someone suggested to me once that the judgment scene at the end of the Sermon on the Mount is really not about salvation and damnation, but it's about something else, because everybody there is calling him Lord. You know, Lord, Lord, you know, did we not do these things in your name and so forth? And my response to that would be, well, nobody's going to call Jesus anything but Lord on the last day. See, you can't call him Frank on the last day. See, you have to call him Lord, see, whether you want to or not. See. But in between now and then, and this is actually maybe the center of the message of this pericope. In between now and then, things are hidden. And they don't look like, to sound again like Dr. Okamoto for a while, they don't look right, at least a lot of the time. And so in that sense, as Lutherans, I think we have a particular opportunity to rejoice in the theology of this text, because it really is about the hiddenness of the reign of God and the unexpected character of what it's like when God breaks into the world to be king, right? It's really about the fact that it doesn't look all that good sometimes. By the way, this is to Tony Cook's marvelous homily this morning, if you were able to be in chapel, about the King Jesus. It was a wonderful, wonderful homily. So anyway, that's the first part. The second part, is sort of easy enough to structure. Thank you, Luke. There's a couple of questions. What did you go out in the wilderness to see? And we talked about how to translate that last time. And the third question, yes, John's a prophet, but if that's all you think that he is, that's not good enough. See, remarkably, the crowds never seem to respond to Jesus' teaching. There's in chapter 21, I cited 21:16. Take a look at that, actually, when Jesus is in Jerusalem. It looks to me like a typo. It should be 21:26 there. So I apologize for that. When Jesus has asked, verse 23, about his authority, then he responds and says, well, how about John's authority? And they refuse to answer. Verse 26, if we say, this is the chief priests and the elders of the people, verse 26, if we say from men, we fear the crowd, for all hold John to be a prophet. See, if this is accurate, it means that the crowds, that they don't understand John aright. Because he is a prophet, but he's more than a prophet. See? And the true, in fact, is the same is true of Jesus in a certain way. So that verse 10 of the text, this is point B3 now, is really, in a sense, the crucial understanding of John the Baptizer. He's the Malachi 3 messenger, right? Who also is important because he points to another, right? And we already know this from chapter 3, where he's the voice of Isaiah 40. It really is. This is really a basic point, but one of my graduate students pointed this out to me in a wonderful way. In He Cho, some of you will know In He. She's working on irony as part of the portrayal of the death of Jesus in the Passion narrative. And because irony, it can be defined different ways, but irony essentially involves the conflicting interaction of two sets of values or two realities. And you could call it surface and deeper or higher and lower, doesn't matter how you name it. But it involves two clashing points of view or values or something like that, theologies. And the observation she made was you would expect there to be a lot of irony in the biblical story because of Genesis 3. And I thought to myself, that's a really smart thing to say. Because ever since humanity's fall into sin, you have humanity's way of doing things and you have God's way. And they are constantly, not the same. They're coming into conflict with one another. So here's the point. To be used by God is to come into a place of conflict. I don't know any way around it except the second coming. Right? And to be used by God as the one greatest of those born of women is to find yourself in a prison about to have your head cut off. So again, it's that probably not just Lutheran, because I've read it from non-Lutheran authors as well, but it's a distinctively Lutheran, the hiddenness. And as I understand, at least, the phrase theology of the cross, which I think can have different meanings just because words can have different meanings, it's narrowly understood, it's that God works through opposites. Now, again, you can expand that meaning and so forth, but at least historically, I think, as I understand it, I'm no expert on this, it's not the theology that comes from the cross, the salvation, forgiveness of sin, and so forth. The theology of the cross is the declaration that God works through opposites. And the cross is the big opposite, right? Well, I think you can see it. That's what we have here. See, we have the greatest among the greatest of all the people ever born among women, not because John is so special, but because of the task that he's been given, because of identity as the messenger of Malachi, you know, as Elijah, who comes before the great and terrible day of the Lord. So, now this is theology to ponder, you know, and with no little fear and trembling, you know, to seek to live and to embrace, you know. It doesn't mean that ministry is always hard, you know, but it means that ministry will certainly sometimes be hard, and it will look like the opposite of what it actually really is. So blessed is the one, then, really blessed is the one who is not caused to stumble because of me, Jesus said. Because I'm the only Jesus you're going to get. To sound like Dr. Nagel a little bit. I do Jesus in the only way that you're allowed to do Jesus, so to speak. So that's really kind of a lot wrapped up in verse 10. And then Jesus, with his amen, truly I say to you, seems to be explaining or explicating the greatness of John. And then you have this odd verse, verse 12, that we talked about at some length in terms of how to translate it and so forth. But if what I suggested, and I'm following the work of others here, is correct, then you get explicitly out in the open this hidden truth about the reign of God, where the reign of God is being violently attacked and violent people are trying to snatch it away. So, yeah, Mike.
Just what you were saying before about the God working through opposites and the conflict, I've just, as I've been reading through Matthew, had a lot of conflict in my mind between the ideas we were just talking about and then as a lay person or teaching to lay people, how do you live with a foot in both kingdom, where you have in the reign of Christ it's opposites and Jesus alone is the king, but then foot in the secular world where you need to get along and you need to work together for community. And just, I don't even know
Uh huh. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think our doctrine of creation, you know, comes into play. We should attend to that, and you know, not. This is why, for instance, if you preach and teach this, you shouldn't always preach in overt contradictions, because that's not the way human beings normally work. Their brains aren't made to work that way all the time, so that's why you like are clear and explain things. And you know, I mean, really, I got this actually from a wonderful fourth-year student interview that Bob Kolb and I did, and I won't tell you the student, although I could. It was a terrific interview, and he made this very point. He said, "You can't neglect the rhetoric of communicating and being with people. You can't just stand back and hurl word and sacrament at people from a distance, because that's not how God made people to function." See, it was a wonderful answer because it was theological. See, it was flowing out of his understanding of the doctrine of creation and anthropology. Right? And I can't answer. I don't even know what all the questions are about, you know, the two hands of God and the. I do know that the fourth gospel, in the fourth gospel, Pilate says, "So you are a king then?" And Jesus, so Pilate is operating out of the one hand, right, not knowing it. And Jesus says, "My reign, my kingship is not of this world. If it were, my followers would fight." Okay, and I think often we don't let that second verse drop, and my reign or my kingship is not of this world comes to mean, yeah, it's up there as opposed to down here. No. The kingship of Jesus is down here. It's being manifested down here. But what are the rules? The answer is, you're not allowed to fight. You're not allowed to use force. See? Kind of like John the Baptizer. Okay? And how we make our way can be a very challenging, difficult thing. Military chaplains face this, right? Hospital chaplains. I mean, if you're assigned to a hospital ward where you've got all kinds of people, you know, really face this, but pastors face it and just Christians as well. So I say this with some trepidation. It's usually a better idea to let yourself be taken advantage of than to stand up for your rights. It's usually a better idea to be naive than to be cynical. It's better for the soul. Jesus says something about that in the Sermon on the Mount. If he conscripts you for 1 mile, go 2. If he wants to take your shirt, give him your jacket too. I don't know. I think we need to stick close to Jesus in order to figure this out. I'm 55. I'm ordained since 1979. I don't have a clue.
I mean, Dr. Myers, on two classes, we had LCMS congressman from Illinois come speak.
Yeah.
And that's really brought more of this to the head. How do I counsel if I have a person in my church who's an active member in an LCMS congregation?
Uh-huh.
How do I counsel somebody in government, or even doesn't have to be federal government?
Yeah. Counsel him to work for the good and protect the widow and the orphan. That's a good place to start. Yeah, he won't know always what the answer is, and neither will you. And if his job, this is why that's actually a good thing to have a representative democracy, because the representative gets to do what he thinks is right. Right? Now, they might vote you out of office for doing that, but that's okay. Nobody ever got saved by being in office. I don't think, did they? Yeah, tough stuff though. But we do need to be out there and involved, actually. And, you know, Christian city council people and journalists and, you know, I should have Uwe Simonetto come blasting in here and, you know, say things with a cool German accent, that kind of thing. So, yeah, Mike?
Part that taken by Dr. Graham.
Yeah.
There's class really honed in on being
a
figure out when we're not operating within the church and within the realm of grace and mercy, that when we're out in God's right hand kingdom,
right? Right.
You know, the rules are the same, and we function by the same rules, but they're not the same because we're dealing with people and not God. So.
Right. And the tactics are different.
Yeah.
Okay. So right.
Just kind of distinguishing the strategy.
Right, insofar as that lies within our power, yeah. By the way, I will mention this. I'd be interested. I haven't had a chance to talk to any of my colleagues because we were all on break and everybody diasporized, you know. But the latest issue of the Fort Wayne Journal has an essay by Dr. Larry Rast, who teaches church history and is the academic dean up at the Fort Wayne Seminary. Very nice article, as far as I am able to evaluate it, on Luther's sort of two kingdoms doctrine. And kind of the limits on it. So if you're interested in this, it was a very interesting article. I'd like to talk to Aaron or Cole or somebody and get their evaluation, but it made a lot of sense to me. So if you're looking for something to read, it was kind of a nice cautious piece on this, on how essentially the message is this isn't going to fix all our problems, and it's not the same as separation of church and state. So yeah, so it was a good article, and it does pertain at least somewhat to this text because we're talking about the hidden and the revealed and. You know, and those kinds of things. So. The end of the text is point 5 on page 2. Begin with an explanatory gar, one of my favorite words in all of Greek language. The pirate word, right? Gar. And John is significant because he brings to an end the era of prophecy and so forth, the one in prison. So I would suggest that 10 to 12 are really the core of the text, especially the second half of it. So theology, which we've been kind of doing anyway. Point 1, Jesus actually is the eschatological judge and savior, the coming one. This issue is a question, and again, remember, it's always good to, I think, say this. Confessional unity does not entail agreement on exegesis of every passage. Okay? So I have friends who think that the fathers, with apparently the exception of Tertullian, were right in saying that John himself really didn't have any questions, but that he was doing this purely for the sake of his disciples. Now, in my judgment, my highly informed, erudite, textually based judgment. What? Well, I'm twice as humble as you are, Carl. And proud of it. You have to read something into the text. The verbs are singular. John sent. John said. Right. Participle legon, not legantes. Right. So I think John is like Elijah in 1 Kings. What is it? 19, which follows 1 Kings 18. Right. Isn't 18 the battle at Mount Carmel and the glorious victory? And 19, Jezebel's going to whack him. Just all of a sudden, he's in despair or something. I don't know if he's in despair, but he's not a happy camper. Kill me now, Lord. I'm the only one left. See, take my life. So I think that's part of that. I don't think we have to conclude either that John has stopped believing, or, even worse, that John is somehow excluded from the blessings of the reign of God. But he has a real question. And so Jesus answers it. And he says, this is what I've been doing, but... Yeah, Mark?
Is there a way here that... It seems to me that John opens up and he baptizes Jesus as the forerunner and he acknowledges the authority.
Seems to.
Now here he's forerunning again and he's questioning what does this authority mean? And from here on out, everybody's doing that same question.
Nice observation.
Now,
right.
No, so in some ways he's being a forerunner, but it's a forerunner.
Even though he doesn't know it.
Even though he doesn't know it.
That's
you know, because nobody... Really, you know, there's some foreshadowing, but there's no real questions about authority until now.
Right.
And now, the prophet's asking this, so we all can go out.
And this generation is rejecting Jesus, and in chapter 12 they want to kill him, and in 13 you've got the seed, most of which doesn't come up, and blah, blah, blah. No, that's a very good observation that I've never quite put together in that way. That even though he doesn't know it, here again John is anticipating and functioning as forerunner. Yeah. Right. Well, and he is, and this is another obvious one, that is, he's about to die.
Yeah, and he does that. The only thing he doesn't forerun Jesus in is resurrection.
Exactly. So John is about to die, and in that sense, he fulfills his calling as the forerunner of Christ. Right. Yeah, that's a very nice way to put that together. Thank you. See what happens when you read the Bible? It's a great thing. Yeah, Adam.
Why are you saying that John doesn't know he's doing? But he has some idea.
Yeah. Go ahead, Mark. In a very specific sense, Adam.
He's being the negative forerunner of, okay, I'm the first one that's going to ask questions of what your authority and what you're actually doing here. You know, the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the crowds and everybody else after this question, all of a sudden the floodgates are open and everybody attacks Christ.
Right.
Up until now, all you've gotten is the authority and everybody's,
The crowds marvel.
Such
right.
Authority.
Right. And this actually goes to the structure of Matthew. That from 11:2 to 6 to the confession at Caesarea Philippi, it's not in every pericope, but you get this constant refrain of who is Jesus? How are people responding to Jesus? Is it faith or opposition, hatred?
He replicates all the miracles that came before. He does all these miracles.
Yeah.
John asks, he says, look at what I've done, and then he replicates them all. But after each one of these, somebody's questioning that miracle, saying that's not good.
Yeah.
That's not a good sign.
Right, yeah. And again, this in Matthew, this phrase, this generation's function begins to function at 11:16, right after this text. So, and this generation in Matthew is Jesus' contemporaries who are in the process of rejecting him. That's who they are. So, Ted?
Just restating in another way, it appears that John doesn't fully understand the nature of the kingdom.
Yes, not fully.
This is kind of the turning point. He was thinking of a different type of kingdom, and that's why he's questioning, because it's
right.
Like, you know, why is this happening?
Right.
And it said that.
Yep. Yes, if I can refer back to the first page, A1. John's question on the surface reading indicates some wondering in his mind, at least about the timing of how and when. It's the how, I think, that he's not getting at this point. To be honest, I obviously we're not told the mind of John the Baptizer after his disciples returned. I'm completely comfortable with this thought, just a speculation, that when the messengers came back to John with Jesus' reply, he said, "Hallowed be thy name. Thy will be done." I mean, he might not have said those words, but he said, "Okay, now I get it." See? That, yeah, so again, I don't think we have to be pessimistic about, or overly pessimistic about John's misunderstanding, which is similar to, he didn't quite get it when Jesus was baptized. Yeah. I mean, so again, I don't think we have to consign John to perdition or something, you know, radical like that. This is just a teaching moment in the ministry of Jesus.
It makes him very different than the Pharisees. The Pharisees just don't get it.
Right.
And they have this, you know, the same type of thing. Yeah. This has been my biggest thing is coming way in the past my ministry, seeing the Pharisees, it's a little too close for comfort.
Yes. I hate it when the scripture meddles with my life. Yes, that's right. Pat.
Well, I was just going to say, I don't see why people have such a big problem saying that John had doubts. Every great prophet in the scripture had doubts at one point or another.
Jeremiah 20.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
And you brought it up earlier, but you know, Jesus comes to be baptized.
Yeah.
And he was a sinful human. He was a great human.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. I haven't looked at this extensively, but I know Chrysostom, he has it's very handy, in one volume of the post-Nicene Fathers set are Chrysostom's homilies on Matthew. So I just bought it, and it's on my shelf so I can read what, you know, at least something of what Chrysostom thought in the 5th century. But my impression is that they all run to John 1 and say, it's impossible for the one who said, "Behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world," to have, you know, stumbled. They just can't conceive of that.
Then how do they deal with Peter?
Well, I agree with you. Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah. But that's the argument. I mean, and I'd have to go back and look specifically, but they simply cite that passage and say, it's impossible. So that I think is essentially the argument. And it would probably be nuanced and, you know, buttressed in various, you know, good and godly ways, but I just don't think it's probably not right. So, but again, it's one of those things where people can investigate and disagree and so forth. So
it's response of what will be done after that. Is that necessarily is that stumbling? Or is that just, you know, interaction, you know, Abraham interacting with God, if there's 10 people there?
Yeah, well, yeah, again, we don't need to be overly pessimistic about John, right. But he is asking a genuine question, and he learns, and the crowds, and we, the reader, you know, have a great opportunity to learn something very important. And we all say this, we say it glibly, people, Christians in other parts of the world or who've had more difficult lives than I have, say, you know, that suffering is God's way of working in our lives. You know, I had one of my elders, who was a young guy, now he's probably about 65 or something, who had been diagnosed with a serious heart condition kind of out of the blue, which just completely affected their lives. And he told me once that he was, on his better days, he was glad that God had given this to him. He said, because it kept him on his knees. See, it prevented him from wandering away into his own self-sufficiency. Well, I was like 28 when he told me that. I'm just completely blown away. I'm supposed to be this man's pastor? Oh, well, here we go. I think it's a good idea to admire the people of God. Have I said that to you guys? It's a very good idea to admire the people of God and the work that God has done in their lives a long time before you got there, and that he'll be doing a long time after you are gone. In a good way, of course, I mean. Yeah, because it's remarkable. So, but you get to be part of it, and that's a good thing. Let's see, where are we? I have no idea. Oh, page 3, I think. The baptizer's question. And if you would look at page 3, we'll kind of keep plowing our way forward here. But I really do appreciate the observations and the questions. It makes it interesting as opposed to boring. that's kind of an irony. So Jesus answers yes. He highlights the miracles and the preaching, and so it's an opportunity to be, not only to assert that Jesus fulfills the Old Testament's promises, but that the miracles themselves are important. They are deeds of salvation. They're not just proofs of his deity, which they probably are, although people that aren't God do miracles, right? So it doesn't necessarily follow that because through you God does a miracle that you're Yahweh or something, you know. Elijah would probably resist that thought. But rather, the miracles are needed to show, I'm just reading the outline there, the extent they reveal just how fallen the world is. I was thinking about this again today. I mean, we've had so many tragic, sad things, deaths and in and around our community over the holiday. It was just kind of overwhelming the other day. This thought had occurred to me some months ago, theologically at least. I mean, when I get sick, I'm as big a baby as anybody else, and I never have been seriously ill with cancer or something like that. But I don't want to be well. I want to be immortal. I don't want to not have colds or not get bad knees. I want to live forever with God because that's what he made me to be. So the problem isn't sickness, it's death. Right? And so when we get sick, at least on some levels, we maybe ought to say, well, yeah, I kind of knew that was coming. You know, you don't have to be too grim about it. Why? Because we're still fallen, we're still mortal, and sickness is just death on the way. Right? I know I've said that. But I want to be immortal. I want to be a real human, you know, that's holy and that lives before God in righteousness and purity forever, to sound like you know who. Okay? And so all these deaths, they just remind us that that's the last enemy that in principle Christ has already overcome, right? Because he is risen indeed, right? But the goods aren't fully delivered yet and the world isn't fully transformed, which is why it's all hidden, which is why we're in Matthew 11. Did you notice that segue? Unbelievable. I get paid for doing this. It's unbelievable. So, yeah. Well, let's hear it for the word, oh God. So anyway, Jesus has come to save his people from their sins. And so one, this is point IV, or as you people from Rome say, four. One key central element to preaching the miracle of Jesus then is to proclaim the promised final restoration of all things, the day when the sea will never again be a dangerous place, the day when people, when children will never again die. Right? That's part of proclaiming the miracles of Jesus. Now, you got to be careful not be sort of silly neo-Pentecostal and blah, blah, blah about it. But you guys are smart and you know how to do that. Don't you? Right? Yeah. Any neo-Pentecostals in here? No, I won't. But you're only second year, so you're good to go. You got time to. I was a neo-Pentecostal when I entered the seminary. So everybody my age kind of went through a Pentecostal phase. So, yeah. And then I hit the buzzsaw of Lutheran theology. Oh, this is a lot better. I don't have to turn my brain off for this. So, okay. John is eschatological Elijah, right? And Mark, this is your point that you made nicely a minute ago. John and Jesus are closely parallel, and even in ways that I hadn't thought, right? So there's lots of parallels in Luke as well, but also in Matthew between John and Jesus. He's the voice of Isaiah 40. He even looks like Elijah, right? And now on page 4, actually I added some new stuff here because this is another difficult question. Look at verse 11 of the text. Truly I say to you that a greater than John the Baptizer has not arisen among the born ones of women, right? But the lesser, literally, mikrateros is a comparative adjective from mikros, small, smaller, less, lesser. But the normally translated least, smallest, in the reign of the heavens is greater than he. So the question is, what is that latter clause refer to? And there's a long tradition that takes this as a reference to Jesus himself. Okay? And I just have a little note there. At times, this is a B-I on top page 4. At times, especially in the earlier tradition of the church's reading, interpreters have concluded that the least in the reign of heaven refers enigmatically to Jesus himself. And in this understanding, Jesus' humility and, I actually love this phrase, divine condescension, would explain the reference to himself as the least. Against this view, however, and it's one of those things I would like to be true, but I just can't bring myself to believe it as accurate. There's no place in Matthew where Jesus refers to himself in such a way, and several times in Matthew, Jesus' disciples are referred to as little or conceptually similar, poor in spirit, and so forth. The view that I think is probably right, is that apparently some older and most modern interpreters conclude that Jesus here is referring to any believer. So that it's really John the Baptizer in this verse is a kind of a foil in that in this verse he belongs in a sense in the age of promise. Okay? But those who are en te basileia are in the age of fulfillment. Okay, so it's not really a criticism of John. It's a way of saying, look what is happening in the world right now. So it's a very historical point, if I could say it that way. And of course, we're 20 centuries later, so it doesn't have the impact that it does. Mike, don't forget your comment. Let me finish this. The force of the saying is to emphasize the newness and the greatness of the reign of heaven in Jesus. He's not excluding the Baptist so much as contrasting him as preparer for the reality now at work. And then there are two parallels, actually. 18:1-4, which is the passage about the children being the greatest. And I gave you a little bit of data there on where we find Mikras and Mikrateras and Elachistas in Matthew. The point is that Jesus uses these words to refer to his disciples, but he never uses these words to refer to himself. So I think exegetically, you can make a much stronger case that the least in the reign of heaven is even the most feeble, fumbling disciple is greater, not because John is bad, but because that for which John has been preparing is now manifesting itself in Jesus. Something like that, if that makes sense. Mike, go ahead.
Does this relate to what Jesus is talking about in Matthew 9, where they ask about why aren't your disciples fasting?
Yes.
Disciples are drinking wine.
Yes. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it's salvation history. Absolutely. Something new is here now.
So old wine and wine skin,
yep.
Wine of promise.
That would be related, yes. Yes.
And then it could also relate to the
the end of 13.
Old
and new. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. Yeah. Again, it's Matthew. Well, it starts with a genealogy, for crying out loud. I was going to say Matthew is an historical document. It's telling a story about what God is doing in history. I started a Bible class at Holy Cross. Renee and I are members down at Holy Cross now, and down by CPH. And I started a Bible class on Sunday, and Tim Wilkins, the pastor, wanted me to do like kind of an overview, here's the Bible kind of thing. I get 11 whole weeks for that. So I think next week we're to cover creation and fall. But I get an hour, so that's good. See, except I'm preaching next week, so it'll be like 50 minutes. So we'll have to really focus here. So I decided what hermeneutical sort of first step did I want to try to make with the group, you know, the first time we met? Kind of get to know each other a little bit so far. So I decided I want to do this one, that I wanted to attack the American, North American penchant, not just North America, Enlightenment probably, penchant for putting ourselves at the center of all things, the center of the universe, so that the Bible is really a book for my life, which, by the way, in a certain sense, it is. See? But the Bible is the story of God's work in the world and for the world. So the goal is not to fit the Bible into me, it's to fit me into the Bible. Right, it's not so much. I like this phrase. I got it from Mark Allen Powell. He talks about microscopic Jesus. Did I tell you this? It's, you know, there's a there's a you have a heart, and there's a little throne in there, you know, and your Jesus is supposed to sit on the throne in your heart, right? So you have microscopic Jesus, right? He's kind of, I mean, there's, you know, no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. I mean, this is a biblical way of speaking, but Americans overdo it, see? And then she says, Jesus lives in your heart, and you take him with him wherever you want to go. He says, wait a minute. Turn it around. It's not him being part of your life. It's you becoming part of his life. Right? And then he takes you wherever he wants you to go. See the difference? And it was, I think it actually worked a little bit. I mean, you know, I don't know the people well in this class yet, but they were kind of going, you know, yeah. And really some of them seem like very well catechized Lutherans and very well informed Christians and so forth, but so something new has happened in history. And see, we can't see it, we don't know it, but God is at work in the world. See, Mike, you said it. Both the hands are his hands. See? So, in Iraq right now, right, God is at work. I mean, the Holy Trinity is at work, shaping the course of history. Now, unless you're a prophet, which is a duty that you don't want to volunteer for, you don't exactly know what he's going to do or what he's doing right now. But God is at work in history, and he's moving it toward a goal. And don't get me started, right? So, but this, it's a completely, it's not about you or me. I mean, we're little. Now, don't worry, God never loses sight of you. See? But it is entirely appropriate and blessed to be small. Because the least in the reign of heaven, see, is greater than the one greatest one born of women. Not because you're so great, but because the reign of heaven is so great. So it just completely inverts, you know, the way we instinctively think about things, because we put ourselves at them. It's a meocentric world, right? So, yep.
Maybe this comes off of that a little bit. Maybe I'm meocentric in this question.
Join the club.
Thinking about Jesus' response to John's question still, and how he points him to what he's doing right now, rather than like launching into some treatise about how he is the incarnation of the second person of the Trinity, right?
Yeah, right.
He says, look at what I'm actually doing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I imagine that, I hope, I'll have people coming to ask me, is Jesus the one or should I expect another?
Right.
And to what extent can I point to things happening right now? Or do nice. I only point
nice.
Into the future?
Nice. So you're right. We, in a sense, our first step is to point back, right, to the. Right? But where do you point people to God's reigning deeds today? I have some places I know. I know that God is always reigning there. Yeah, water. See, bread and wine. See, this is the challenge of liturgical worship, which is our heritage and delight, and please don't be baby boomers. Okay. For some of you, it's too late. but the challenge of it is to speak and act. This will sound bad, as if God is actually doing something every single time. Now, you can also, at times, so for instance, here's a little anecdote. I think it's valid. A few years ago, there was a new student in his family, and they were having a horrible transition time. The wife lost her job. She was depressed. So they asked, and Renee had gotten another wife, so they asked if Renee and I could come over and visit with them, which we said, great. You know, occasionally, you get to feel like a pastor. You know? And oddly enough, I don't quite remember how it happened, because we had planned that Renee would talk to the wife, and I would talk to the husband. See, it ended up being the reverse. Renee and the husband were talking in the living room, and I was sitting at the kitchen table with the wife. And she said to me something like this. This is not a verbatim quote, but she said to me, "What is God doing? I just wish God would send someone to me." Well, I'm not so dense, you know. 2 plus 2. And I don't think I've actually ever said this to anybody else before or afterwards. But I looked her in the eye and I said, he did. He sent me. What was I supposed to say? See? And I'm a sinner, but I'm baptized, and, you know. So there I was, see? So sometimes you can do that. You can be, see, the reign, because the reign of God manifests itself, buckle up, through you, because you belong to Christ. Does that make sense? It's really good stuff. Yeah, but see, that's it. See, it's not that way. It's not all up there for crying out loud. See, it's right here, and God is doing stuff. A lot of times we don't have a clue. The baptizer probably had a clue, but he was shaky. Right? What's going on? Jesus says, "Look." Yeah, he didn't give him a theological treatise. Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's time for that, by the way. I like theology. All right. Do it for a living. So. Good. So that's 11:11. Now, if you want to argue that the least is Jesus, you can do that. And we'll still have beer, but you have to buy. That's the end of the theology section, and we got trajectories to kind of talk about. But boy, we're going fast. More questions. I must not be really wound up. I'm kind of running out of material here. So, anything on this so far? Yep. Go ahead, Anthony.
I'm just kind of thinking on. So
that's what I've been doing.
I'm looking at verse 11 and kind of connecting it with verse 12 as far as.
Well, that's a great idea.
The least in the kingdom of heaven, and then talking, or the reign of heaven, sorry, and then
okay.
In verse 12, the reign of heaven is being violently attacked from the days of John the Baptist until now.
Mm-hmm.
If you take it as Jesus, he really hasn't been violently attacked up till, you know, the first 11 verses.
Right.
Yeah, right.
The
first 11 chapters of
right.
The book of Matthew.
Not so much, right? You had Herod.
Yeah.
That was pretty violent.
Well,
yeah. But no, you're quite right. I mean, there
John
hasn't.
John the Baptist has.
Right.
Which. Forerunner
mm-hmm.
for us all, dying first and all.
Right. And see, and then the opposition to Jesus is fixing to rise at this point in the narrative. Because in 10, he's told the 12 that they're going to be attacked, they're going to be hated, or the 12, I mean. So yeah, I think you're right. But by the way, not least, I think this there's probably a positive correlation, Anthony, between those who want. I think there is some correlation, not necessary, between those who want to take the least in the reign to be Jesus and the way you translate the first clause of verse 12. See? I think there's some correlation there, and some want to translate the reign of God is forcefully advancing. Okay. So again, it's a very complex text, grammatically, syntactically, theologically. But I think that's a good observation, and I think that some people would want to make that connection. Yeah. But another interesting, did you see that how verse 12 kind of, verse 11 puts John in the former era, right? Verse 12 kind of puts him over here with Jesus, right? From the days of John until now, the reign of heaven is being attacked. And so John is this really pivotal sort of, again, theological colossus that strides, you know, that stands astride the two ages. So, yeah. But he is Elijah. By the way, if you haven't read it recently, let's take a look. Handy dandy NIV out here at Malachi. Let's see what that looks like. By the way, there's a lot of, as you know, varied eschatological messianic speculation going on in this time period, right, in the first century. There are Elijah documents, right, the apocalypse of Elijah. I mean, there's plenty of speculation going on about this passage in Malachi 3 and 4 in Second Temple Judaism, right? And so when Jesus says John is Elijah, they're not going to, you know, people in general are probably not going to say, huh, boy, never thought about Elijah before. See? No, they know this passage, and it shows up at Qumran and in other documents that you can read in English translation if you're interested in actually getting to sleep at night, because it's not edifying, but it is sort of significant. Malachi 4, that little short, surely the day is coming. Could you like hum that particular aria from the Messiah while I read this? Well, you couldn't hum it. Okay, that's fine. Surely the day is coming. I grew up on Sunday mornings, except during Lent, to the smell of shoe polish and the sound of Handel's Messiah. My father was polishing our shoes so we could go to church with polished shoes. Now when I got older, he made me polish my own shoes. And the sound of Handel's Messiah, for he is like a refiner's fire, and who shall stand when he appeareth? That's the King James. You know, I don't actually, but that's because my sense of smell is kind of defective anyway. But if I was more righteous, I would. Surely the day is coming, it will burn like a furnace. All the arrogant and every evildoer will be stubble. Oh, this kind of sounds like John's preaching in chapter 3. Right? I mean, fire and chaff and stuff, right? Every evildoer will be stubble, and that day that is coming will set them on fire, says the Lord Almighty. Not a root or branch will be left to them. The axe is laid to the root. I was extrapolating there. But for you who revere my name, the Son of Righteousness will rise with healing in its wings, and you will go out and leap like calves released from the stall, which is a beautiful sight when you see it. Then you will trample down the wicked. They will be ashes under the soles of your feet. On the day when I do these things, says the Lord Almighty, remember the Torah of my servant Moses, the decrees and laws I gave him at Horeb for all Israel. See, I will send you the prophet Elijah before that great and dreadful day of the Lord comes. He will turn the hearts of the father to the children, hearts of the children to their father, or else I will come and strike the land with a curse. And of course, Luke 1, you know, that Gabriel says to Zechariah, you know, that John will go before the Messiah in the spirit and power of Elijah, right? So Matthew isn't the only gospel, of course, that proclaims John's identity. But again, it's the last day. You know, this, what's going on here is the great and terrible day of the Lord, because that's when Elijah shows up. See? But it doesn't look like it. It kind of does, because Jesus is casting out demons, right? He's raising the dead, and he's healing the sick. See? But it kind of doesn't look like it. So it's this, again, it's this back to this theology of hidden reality, and blessed is the one who is not caused to stumble. Okay? So blessed is the pastor who is not caused to stumble, when his visible reality doesn't look all that great, you know. So it'll happen, to a greater or lesser extent. So, I think. Mark?
Okay, before break, you gave us a absolutely brilliant...
What do you want, money or what?
Yeah, you want money, actually.
Oh, I do, that's right, for the flowers.
$5, yeah, it's only $5. Well, you got change?
You owe me money, too.
I do not owe you money.
That's what your name is like.
Cash.
Did you notice how quick that was?
I am rhetorically as sophisticated as a 2x4. Yes, Mark, please continue.
Okay, I'm Beyazitai.
Your
argument for taking Beyazitai middle and...
Yeah, pass and all that stuff, right?
...clauses as negative. And so over break, I had nothing better to do. So I...
Car broke down, couldn't travel.
I did a little reading on the opposite argument.
Yeah, good.
Taking them positive.
Good.
And there's this guy, Brad Young.
His
book is, he really focuses in on all of the varieties of messianic expectations.
Yeah, good.
And he brings up this verse, the verses from Malachi, but he also really strongly brings up a verse from Micah chapter 2.
Okay.
He says that both of these verses were really heavy in those times.
Yeah, used by
what are the
right
expectations?
Okay.
Of Messiah, and he also gives a little background of these verses. If you start in Micah 2:12,
okay,
because the background of this is that the shepherds, when they had a sheep pen, they wouldn't actually have a wooden gate. They would just take stones and they would pile them up.
Okay.
And then in the morning, the shepherd would have to break through these stones in order, mm-hmm. order to let the sheep out.
Okay.
So in Micah 2:12, it says, "I will surely gather all of you, O Jacob. I will surely bring together the remnant of Israel. I will bring them together like sheep in a pen, like a flock in its pasture, a place with thronging people." So that brings up that imagery. And then 13 is the one snakes open the way will go up before them.
Mm-hmm.
They will break through the gate and go out. The king will pass through before them, the Lord of their head.
Okay.
And he says two figures, the Elijah, which is to come,
okay,
and the king.
Oh, so he matrixes this passage and Elijah, Malachi.
Right.
Oh, okay. Do they occur to, you may not remember, do they occur together? Because one of the exegetical techniques in Judaism at the time is to just slam two passages together if they think they mutually interpret them.
Yes,
okay,
exactly.
So these two are brought together.
Yeah, in fact,
okay.
Can we just
oh, yeah, no, I believe it, yeah.
And he says the one who breaks open the way is Elijah. And
okay.
And he matrixes that right up into, you know, Matthew 11:12.
Ah, okay.
Says, okay, well then Elijah is, because we're talking about John here,
he's
the breaker.
He's forcing things open.
Right.
Okay.
So he takes this as the kingdom breaks through.
Mm-hmm. Is the language the same in the Septuagint, do you know? I mean, is it Beazo?
I don't think that, he doesn't get into the Septuagint.
Okay. Well, I mean, it sounds like a cogent sort of argument. I have to read it. But this is the way you would, by the way, this is the way you would argue if you wanted to, and by the way, Don Carson, I think, great exegete, up at Trinity Deerfield. I'd have to go back and look, but I'm pretty sure he takes the first clause of verse 11 this way, that the reign of God is forcefully advancing. And he just points to the miracles that Jesus is doing. So, I mean, you can make an exegetical argument for this case, absolutely, and this is part of the way of how you would do it. I tend to think it doesn't. I mean, I do think it doesn't fit as well into sort of the lexical data and the context. But to be sure, a case can be made, right? Absolutely, and it's again, this is actually one of the first things I said today is remember that, because sometimes students will say to me, they're preaching on a text in Matthew and they're operating under this assumption that I'm somehow the czar of Matthew or something. So they say, well, I hope I didn't preach false doctrine. And the answer is, what they really mean to say is, I hope I sort of was a skillful exegete when I interpreted this text. Because you're not going to preach false doctrine, you're Lutherans, right? So you know not to say you have to earn your way to heaven and, sacraments are symbolic. Everybody knows, nobody's going to say those things, right? Right? Okay, yeah, see. No, put that hand down.
The question Adam looked up on the Antichrist.
On the Antichrist. What's the Septuagint of Micah? Do we have Beazo going on there?
No.
Okay. Well, that might be a... Okay. Yeah. So, but apparently Young's argument would be that these two texts, and this does happen, have been slammed together in other Jewish documents of the period. And so he's probably, I'm guessing now, arguing that sort of often when Malachi 4 was interpreted, Micah 2 was not far behind. That would be his argument, apparently. Yeah. It's not a bad argument. Okay. So. Good. So anyway, the point is you don't have to agree with one another on every exegetical passage, because our doctrines aren't based on one passage, right? I think. Are they? Not that I know of. Yeah. Okay, good. Okay, well, trajectories. We have some minutes left, so let's just maybe take a look. We've talked about these, I think. The hiddenness of the reign of God is, this is at the very bottom of 4, is very much like, St. Paul's way of saying it is the foolishness of the cross or strength in weakness. Again, that's that ironic, paradoxical thing that's going on. By the way, it's not surprising, because St. Paul has to be read in his historical context as well, that in Corinth, Roman Corinth, in the middle of the first century, is an up-and-coming, competitive, wealthy, entrepreneurial context. Sound familiar? See? Anthony Thistleton's commentary on 1 Corinthians does a wonderful job of, obviously, it's a very different place because it's an ancient city and we're not ancient people, but there's some remarkable parallels between what's going on in Corinth in terms of the self and competition, sexual morality. I mean, I actually get to teach 1 Corinthians again. I haven't taught in a couple of years in the spring, and I'm pretty sure we're going to use Thistleton's commentary, although it's like 1,300 pages of it. You need a, you know, like a cart just to carry the thing. But it's to that context, see. It's to that context. These are not poor, oppressed people. These are competitive, status-oriented people. And it's to them that Paul says, the gospel, pal, is foolishness. It's weakness. And Thistleton makes the point that chapter 15 is where it is for a reason. Have you ever thought about this? I never thought about this. I resolve to know nothing among you but Christ and Him crucified. In the same letter, you get the greatest chapter on Christ resurrected. I thought he said nothing but Christ and Him crucified. And what Thistleton suggests is this amazing quote that I always cite from him. He says, yeah, well, they couldn't have, they weren't ready for the transforming power of the resurrection until they had discovered the lowliness of the cross. See? First things first. You got to die before you can be raised to life. Which is why in baptism our lives aren't repaired. Did this occur to me too? We're not fixer-uppers when we're born. Right? Foundation's basically solid, knock out a few walls, everything will be fine. Fix the wiring, no way. Tear the place down and build a new one. Okay. Thistleton is really smart. He uses a lot of big hermeneutical terms too, so that's cool. Anyway, Paul does the same thing, I think. He probably got it from Jesus. We've talked about Jesus' baptism is like this, a lowly baptism in the place of sinners. Baptism of Christ is the gospel for this coming Sunday. The parables of chapter 13, you know, if we kind of move forward, we talked about a little bit of this when Mark made his comment earlier. I think they're related to this paradox, namely that many in Israel are rejecting Jesus. The reign of God is being violently attacked. There's different ways to summarize the parables of chapter 13, but one of the summary statements could be something like this. These parables explain why it's not going real good. It's because the reign of God is like a mustard seed. That's why. The reign of God is like leaven. The reign of God is like a guy finding treasure in the field. It's like a dragnet. You know, you get all the fish in, but you don't sort them out until the very end. It's like a guy whose field is sown with tares by an enemy, but you're not allowed to separate them out until the end, until the harvest. See? So that's why you know, and it's to the disciples. That's why it's hard. I mean, the parables of chapter 13 in some ways are teaching that this is why it's complicated. Because that's just the way God is doing it in the world. That's the way He's decided to do it.
Right? We're going to go straight to 16 from here.
Yeah, right.
13. Are all of those the field and the furrow of great value? Who's the one who finds it? Is it?
Yeah.
The people who are up in the kingdom of heaven, or is God the one who finds the treasure, or what's the?
Yeah.
Is He the one who buys the deal?
Right. I'm being set up here. I appreciate that. Well, first of all, everybody know what that sound is? It's the IIA, the idiosyncratic interpretation alert. Okay. Yeah. Really, because one should be humble, and one should not neglect what is virtually the uniform interpretive tradition of the church. Almost uniformly, the church has read those parables. I mean, almost completely, as the believer is the person who finds the treasure, and then at that point, of course. The going and selling all is weakened conceptually to mean something like faith or, you know, whatever. And a Christian interpretation is given. I don't know. I'm getting probably less confident, if that were possible, in my middle age, but I just can't believe that. I think an exegetical case can be made that, and maybe the strongest observation that I
somebody else made one time, is that in the parables of the reign of God, the protagonist is always God or Jesus. These are parables about what God is doing, which, by the way, makes sense. It's after all the reign of God. So, you know, I think Jesus is the man who finds the treasure. I think Jesus is the merchant who finds the pearl. Yeah. It's a little different, isn't it? Yeah, apparently Wugazer has never heard this before. So, now, what he's saying, wow, he says, I could have had that $20. Wow.
It's sandwiched right in between he's the owner of the field. And
exactly.
He's the guy who brings in the net to the fish.
Yeah, yeah, there's no explicit guy dragging in the net, but it's kind of him.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah, Carl?
Then what's the pearl?
You.
But on the house that needs to be completely torn down before it can be rebuilt.
This is so great. I couldn't have set this up better in my life. That's why it's called grace. Just as Israel, Exodus 19, is God's segulah, his peripoiesis, his treasured possession. Right? In other words, Carl, unfortunately, it's not about you or about me. Yeah. Yeah, no, this is the nature of grace, that we become treasure. Yeah, if you're interested in an argument, I actually wrote one up about 20 years ago now. So I published it in the Fort Wayne Journal.
And unfortunately, the first group of ends.
I know. Well, you know, this might actually get you in the dang library instead of looking at your stupid Antichrist and just, oh, I can do everything online, oh yeah. I can download music. I'm so cool. Just get out. Get a life. Go to the library, for crying out loud. Somebody had a penetrating comment.
Well, I was just thinking about how you started that, saying almost uniformly the church has gone the other way.
Yeah, it has. Absolutely. I did the research, actually.
So, like...
For once.
I mean... Okay, so then if it's clear, if we're all decided that it's the other way, uh-huh. And the church has been wrong.
On this passage? A lot of people have been wrong.
For a long time.
Yeah.
And then, so then I'm wondering, like, well, the church has been wrong on that one passage,
mm-hmm.
But they did all right. So then I'm wondering, like...
still had baptism, still had the sacraments,
like,
yeah.
Interpretation of particular scripture.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, how central is it, or is allegory the end of the world, or... You know, I'm just kind of like,
it
just makes you think when we can say something like that.
Yeah, I know. It does me too. And more as the years go by. I don't know any Latin, but I think this means to the sources, right? That every generation goes back, you know. Well, I mean, we have, what's his name? The little short, fat German guy, Luther? As the I mean, you know, what did he do? See, he went back to the scripture and discovered... And again, what's interesting is that there are a couple of voices, even from the early period. I'd have to go back and look now, who seem to take these two little parables of the hidden treasure and the pearl of great price as in a Christological way. So it's not completely new. It's just pretty new. Yeah. So, yeah. So again, that's a little humility goes a long way. But... Yeah. So what you do is you make a case, you do your homework, you set it out in front of people, and you say, what do you think? And try to stay humble.
Because the confessions don't tell us which way to go in that parable.
They don't, actually, yeah. Yeah, not that I can think of. And by the way, I'm not quite sure precisely how to say this, but we're not bound to all the exegetical conclusions of the confessions either, are we? I didn't think so. Yeah. Melanchthon or somebody mentions astrology in there too somewhere. Everything is located in history. To say that doesn't mean that, you know, it doesn't have eternal abiding significance. To say that something is contextual doesn't necessarily deny that it's eternal. We might think, for instance, of the incarnation. So. Yeah, so anyway. Right, so we are going to chapter 16 here in about 1 minute, actually. We'll stop and then we'll pick up at chapter 16. So whatever group is next... But you know, actually, Mark, I want to return to one of your comments earlier. It's not a bad way to think about the material that leads up to Caesarea Philippi. It's who is Jesus? Who is he? How are people responding to him? And in Israel, the opposition is rising, and yet there are those, his disciples, who seem to be getting it, and then we finally reach this climactic text in chapter 16, which ends the middle large section. And that's where we'll pick up on whatever day next.